This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, a group of concerned professionals got together in Williston to talk and learn about impaired driving. The group included researchers, first responders, law enforcement officers, and politicians. They were looking at how to combat and prevent impaired driving. Not just drunk driving, but looking as well at other substances that can cause a driver to be impaired but are not as easily determined by a roadside test. They heard about what officials in Colorado have learned in the last couple of years since marijuana was legalized there, and they shared resources. But people who focus on impaired driving are also worried about other things that can lead to accidents. People who are too tired to drive safely, and the vexing problem of distracted driving, often caused by people looking at their cell phones or other technology. Today on the show, we're going to take a look at distracted and impaired driving. We're joined now by Trish Conti, director of the Vermont Forensic Laboratory, and Lieutenant John Flanagan, Vermont State Police Commander of Traffic Operations. It's a pleasure to have both of you on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One of the biggest unanswered questions whenever we do a marijuana show or a distracted or impaired driving show is this question of how to test for impairment for substances other than alcohol. You know, an effective, quick roadside test that can not only tell if somebody has a substance in their bloodstream, but if that's actually causing an impairment. Trish Conti, are we any closer to a roadside test for impairment for other substances?
I think we're getting there, but it's a slow process. There are instruments available to be able to do that function. They're newer, and because it's newer, people have fears about them. We've done a pilot program in Vermont in recent years looking at the efficacy and the effectiveness of these. It was a small pilot program, but it did mimic what's been seen in larger programs. The results are, you know, from a scientific standpoint, they're accurate and they're reliable. I don't have any hesitations about the instrument's performance itself, but I think, you know, having that capability would be a huge resource to officers on the road. I think there's a lot of concern from citizens that they will be asked to take this test, and if they do, if there's any indication of drugs, they're automatically going to be arrested. But the reality is, it's the signs and observations that the officer makes that's going to determine the impairment, not simply a test.
Can you tell me a little bit about the test, just so we have a sense? And this is already in a pilot stage, so people are being subjected. It's probably has too much of a negative connotation, but are being subjected to this test, right?
Correct. In Vermont, in our pilot study, we only had, I believe it was 9 actual post-DUI arrest cases for the study. The rest of them were done through the rapid intervention program out of Chittenden County. So it wasn't necessarily operators. It was just to get the proof of concept for the instrument.
So these weren't people who were pulled over?
Correct. It was people coming in for screenings as part of their probation and parole. So basically, there were two instruments that were tested from two different manufacturers, and they are about the size of a Keurig coffee machine for one of them. The other one's a little bit smaller. And the person is asked to put a cotton swab in their mouth and leave it in there for, you know, 2 to 3 minutes. There's a blue indicator line that says when it's done. After that, the officer will insert a cartridge into the instrument, and 3 to 5 minutes later, it will spit out a ticket, essentially, that says if it's positive or negative for several different classifications of drugs.
So there's no blood test.
No blood test.
You don't have to have a blood test. And what it just tells you the classification of drug. It doesn't tell you the exact drug.
Correct. It won't tell you. It's a qualitative test, which means it doesn't give you a numerical result. It just says positive or negative. So it'll say if it's positive for amphetamines or CNS depressants or cannabis, but it won't tell you what the drug is or how much is in the system.
And that's where the expert person comes in, right? Because, I mean, you could have cannabis in your system that is not actually causing you to be impaired on that day. It could have been, you know, you smoked a joint 3 weeks ago, and that's not causing impairment on the roads today.
Absolutely. And that's true for any test, whether it be blood, urine, oral fluids. Just the presence of something is not going to tell you whether or not the person's impaired. That's when we rely on the officer and what they've seen. And also, if there's a drug recognition expert, which is involved, which I'm sure Lieutenant Flanagan will speak on, those are the experts which are actually going to show the indications of impairment.
And so you said, before we go to you, Lieutenant Flanagan, Trish Conti, you said you have no questions about the instrument. You trust that it is an accurate instrument. It's good to use. When do you think we might be able to get it out on the roads for officers?
In order to use the instrument, it's going to take legislative approval to be able to use that type of oral fluid for testing. Right now in Vermont statute, we can only use blood or breath. Obviously, breath is not on the table right now for drug detection. That's why we're looking at oral fluids, to give officers the availability of some sort of instrument which will be likened or akin to the portable breath testing right now they have for alcohol.
And you said we can use blood, but that's not generally done at the roadside.
No, blood is not done. That's done post-arrest as part of the evidentiary process. And that's the result that's actually used in court.
So, Lieutenant Flanagan, have you used this instrument that Trish Conti is talking about?
I have had some experience using the instrument.
What's that been like? Can you talk a little bit about your experience?
You know, they're designed to be very portable and be able to be used in a field environment. And they don't test for every substance out there, but they do test for substances that we commonly see.
And you trust its veracity as well?
We had some pretty good results out of our pilot, but we're not the only area. There's been pilot studies that have been conducted across the country. And our results have been very similar to the results that we've seen across the country with some high reliability.
I sense some hesitation from you to say, yes, I trust it. Is that just because you don't feel like you can say that or because maybe
it's not an evidentiary test. It's a screening device much like we would use at roadside for alcohol or what's called an AlcoSensor or a portable breath testing instrument. So it's a screening device. It is subject. It's not 100%. They do see some false negatives and in some cases – because of sensitivity with the instrument, there have been some false positives.
We're talking today about impaired driving, and right now we're looking at testing for substances other than alcohol. You know, obviously that's a key component of impaired driving, and we don't have a breathalyzer for marijuana, for example. So we're talking a little bit about what might be coming down the pike. We're also going to be looking at drowsy driving and distracted driving, and if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Lieutenant Flanagan, Trish Conti mentioned drug recognition experts, and you have DRE right on the lapel of your uniform. Is that something that you wear because you are a drug recognition expert?
Yes, and I'm one of about 40 within the state that are not only within the Vermont State Police, but other state agencies as well as municipal and sheriff's departments. We've had our drug evaluation and classification program up and running since 2005, but it's nothing new. This was developed back in the late 1970s out of the Los Angeles Police Department and has expanded. Every state is involved in that, and this is all coming about because we're seeing more drug-impaired drivers on our highways today. And we need to have the resources and the expertise to be able to evaluate those drivers to see if whether they are impaired by a substance or that they're impaired by something else, such as a medical condition, because medical conditions can mimic drug impairment as well.
So what do you do in a roadside stop if you suspect somebody is impaired and it doesn't appear to be alcohol or a breathalyzer, you know, shows that it's not alcohol? What do you actually do with a person?
You know, our officers have significant training for alcohol detection. And I will say that alcohol-impaired driving is much more serious and much more prevalent than drug-impaired driving today.
When you say more serious, you just mean because there's more of it?
There is more of it. However, we're seeing, by the numbers, a reduction in alcohol-related deaths, and we're seeing an increase in drug-related deaths. So at roadside stops, they would completed investigation or go forward on investigation much like they would any DUI. So whether there's impairment using their senses, what the driving behavior was of the operator, and then when they have that personal contact using their senses, you know, what they see, what they smell, what they hear, admissions from the driver, and they go about it as an investigation step by step. One of the things that we use after pre-arrest screening is what we call standardized field sobriety tests is they would use that portable breath instrument. But that's only helping us to confirm the presence of alcohol. So in cases where it is a substance, we may see no presence of alcohol or a minimal amount of alcohol that's not consistent with the impairment that we observed. So then that person would be taken for further testing and be brought in front of a DRE in a controlled environment, and they would go through a very extensive evaluation to determine if that person is impaired and whether that impairment is related to a medical condition or by a substance.
So does that include things like being made to walk a straight line or say the alphabet? I mean, the things that you sort of think of or have seen in movies from somebody doing a roadside test?
Yes, but they're, you know, they're standardized tests, and they're really made to measure that psychophysical impairment.
And Trish Conti, you said that it's always going to be a combination of whatever tests we eventually have the legality to use, or that officers have the legality to use, and somebody who's using their senses and that expertise and training to come up with a sense of whether this person is impaired or not. You don't think we're ever going to have one test that says it all, that, yep, okay, I can tell that you're impaired because of this blood test or this fluid test?
No, I think there's a large misconception out there that because everyone is so familiar with the DUI alcohol process, and there's been so many studies done over the years, over the decades, showing that, you know, everybody at 08 is impaired. Everybody's familiar with that.
That's 0.08 for alcohol.
For alcohol. And I think people are trying to force DUI drug cases into that mold, and it just does not fit. If you ask anybody in the medical or scientific community that's familiar with how drugs act on the body, they're never going to be able to say that at this one particular level of a drug, whether it be marijuana or anything else, that everyone is impaired, because drugs affect people so differently. Alcohol is a very simple chemical, but drugs are very different than that. So in DUI drugs cases, the test is not confirmatory. It's supportive. All it does is show what's in the person's system, and that means they took it at some point before that. It's going to be up to the officer to say whether or not impairment was present.
And Lieutenant Flanagan, impairment is really the legal bar here. I mean, can you arrest somebody who has a 0.06 level of alcohol, they blow 0.06, but you saw them weave all over the road. They are clearly impaired. So even though they don't meet the legal limits of alcohol impairment according to the test, is impaired driving really the standard that you're operating on?
It is. We do. We basically have two, really three different subsections in our DUI law. One is an impairment to the slightest degree, and that relates to alcohol and drugs. And then we have our per se, which is our 0.08 limit. So technically, if someone is below the legal limit or the per se limit, they can still be impaired. And we know certainly that impairment can start lower than a 0.08.
So you can arrest somebody for DUI under a 0.08 legally?
Legally, yes.
We got a note from Dana who says there's a Canadian company that's making a marijuana breathalyzer and is very close to bringing it to market. This is handheld and gives immediate results. Trish Conti, are you familiar with this?
I've heard about it, but I haven't looked at the actual instrument itself or any of the data. But it was talked about yesterday and mentioned. I think, you know, marijuana is a little bit different than something like alcohol. It's not a volatile compound, so it's not as easily going to come out onto the breath. So I'm not, I haven't looked at any of the research on this, so I don't know anything about its reliability or accuracy.
Again, today we're talking about impaired driving. We're talking about distracted driving. If you have a question about testing, if you have a question about distracted driving, people with cell phones texting, it's illegal in Vermont, but obviously still happening. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Understand that yesterday at this impaired driving conference, you had some experts come from Colorado to talk about what the experience there has been like since they legalized marijuana and what impact that has had on the roads and on impaired driving. Can you recap a little bit about what the people from Colorado told you about their experience that we might be able to learn in Vermont?
Sure. We had a gentleman come and speak to us yesterday who was the former traffic safety resource prosecutor from Colorado. So he was actually instrumental when legalization of recreational marijuana was happening. He was charged with coming up with some of the statutory changes that were the fallout from that and becoming an expert on marijuana. And he said that the main thing they learned was that things that seemed simple at the time were definitely not as simple as it sounded. So when they were writing the statute and the laws, things that, you know, possession of an ounce or less of marijuana was legal. Well, that's difficult because how many people know exactly what an ounce is from a visual standpoint? Or, you know, the definition of marijuana, things like edibles. There were a lot of things that people thought were easy to handle at the beginning, but ended up causing these huge headaches down the road. So he charged the states that are looking at legalizing to look closely at what other states have done and learn from their mistakes. Because one of the other mistakes he mentioned was some of the states have set per se limits like we have for alcohol at 5 nanograms. And he said, you know, he was a huge proponent for that. And that's one of the major things he regrets, because there is no accurate per se limit, which for marijuana, for the Delta 9 THC, which is the active ingredient. There's no per se limit where that should be accurate, that says everybody is impaired at that level or more.
Lieutenant Flanagan, does legalizing marijuana worry you for any of the reasons that Trish Conte just mentioned?
In some ways it does. And we can look towards Colorado and Washington and some of the data that's coming out. I think Colorado was a little bit challenged to talk about, you know, how they went through the process because it was the constitutional amendment. And I think in a lot of ways the cart was put before the horse. So they didn't have a lot of things, and they were new to this area. And certainly, you know, one of the things that they've learned and they've had problems with is having good baseline data to see what kind of changes that they've seen behavioral that affect public safety. Because health and public safety, I think you've got to really think about having good policies in place before you start to move in this direction. Because there certainly will come social harms with this. And you can certainly see from Colorado that you know, more access, they've had more social harms as a result of this. And a lot of this has been with highway crashes.
We're talking about impaired driving today. When we come back, we're going to zoom out a little bit and look at the big picture in Vermont. What are we seeing in terms of impaired driving and serious accidents that are the result of impaired or distracted driving? And we're going to take your calls and emails. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Trish Conte is director of the Vermont Forensic Laboratory. Lieutenant John Flanagan is Vermont State Police Commander of Traffic Operations. They're with us today talking about the problem of impaired driving and what's being done about it by law enforcement, including new tests to identify people who may be impaired by marijuana or other substances. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a comment or a question on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And before we get to a few of your calls and emails, Lieutenant Flanagan, you mentioned a few minutes ago that we are actually seeing fewer serious accidents or fatalities due to drunk driving. Can you talk a little bit about impaired driving and what we're seeing on Vermont roads right now?
You know, if we look at our arrest data, DUI related to alcohol far outpaces what we're seeing in drug and driving cases. With that, though, drug impaired driving and someone who's under influence of a drug other than alcohol, they present differently. I think most people have had real world experience with someone who has been impaired by alcohol. They know how that person behaves, how they act. There's a mental and physical impairment. And other drugs can present in much different ways, especially when you talk about cannabis. There's more of a mental impairment than there really is a physical impairment.
And in terms of the statistics of what you're seeing of DUIs and driving under the influence of other substances and distracted driving, do you have stats of what we're seeing in Vermont roads and what direction we're going?
We do, and we have very good data when it comes to fatal crashes because those are analyzed much more thoroughly than we see with even major crashes that result in serious injuries. So I don't think – you know, we talk about data, but data doesn't always tell the whole story. But the data that we're seeing in fatal crashes right now, we're starting to see many more serious crashes that result in death that are substances other than alcohol. And if you put the two together, the last couple of years, about 50% of all of our fatalities are related to substance.
But overall, we're seeing fewer fatalities on the roads year by year if you look at them, right, than we were 5 years ago or a decade ago.
We were doing really well until about 2015. Vermont and nationally, we're starting to see a spike in highway deaths. And 2016 for us this year isn't even looking better. But if we look at about the 3 or 4 year average right now, we're not up that much. But Vermont is different because we're really dealing with a small data set. So year to year, we sometimes see, you know, significant increases or significant decreases. So we need to look at sort of longer trends.
Trish Conte, what do you think about what we're doing to combat impaired driving? Are we doing the right things as a state? Are we moving in the right direction overall?
I think we're moving in the right direction, but we still have a lot of room to grow. I mean, we have more DREs being trained and available. We still need some more of those because there's areas of the state which are which have fewer available. So that means officers don't have that extra, you know, arm of expertise to use in their in their decision to arrest. We also, I mean, the testing needs to improve. We that having that roadside capability would be a huge asset to the process. As far as testing at the forensic laboratory, right now the testing for the drug samples that come in as bloods are sent out to a lab in Pennsylvania. We're working on bringing that in-house, which might help with the prosecution of these cases, because a lot of times right now, in order to prosecute these DUI drugs cases, they need to have experts brought in from the lab in Pennsylvania, which is cost prohibitive. If you think about a misdemeanor DUI drugs case, the state's attorney's office can't afford to spend thousands of dollars to bring in expert witnesses. So we're making steps in the right direction, but we definitely have room to improve.
We've talked a lot, though, about tests and, you know, what kinds of tests can be done and what happens when somebody is impaired and they're pulled over or they're in an accident. What about this idea of prevention and education and a culture shift? You know, I think especially as we head into the holiday season or in the midst of it now with various holidays that often include wine or beer or cocktails, or, you know, you're thinking about holiday parties and people often drinking and driving, or as we've talked about, doing other substances and driving. How do we combat this sort of cultural acceptance that I believe there still is, especially in a rural state like Vermont, of drinking maybe a little bit too much and then getting on the roads because I'm probably fine? You know, how do we approach and address that cultural issue before it comes to law enforcement pulling somebody over?
I think there's a misconception out there, and people have this sense of invincibility that until something happens to them, they think it's okay. You have to consider there was a statistic yesterday at the conference where the U.S. has 5% of the world population but uses 75% of the prescription drugs in the world. So people are taking drugs for everything. And I'm not, you know, an anti-medication advocate by any means. Drugs are wonderful things when used properly. But when you consider the options of prescription medications, whether taken legally or illegally, alcohol, marijuana, there's a lot of combinations out there for people. And they might think that, you know, if I have a beer, I'm fine. And if I have one of my pills, I'm fine. But when you take them together, it has huge exponential increases in the effects these drugs are going to have on the body. And I think people just don't understand that simply following their doctor's orders, they might still have some caution that needs to be exceeded.
Lieutenant Flanagan, where do you come in on this part of the conversation?
You know, education and outreach are really a big part of this, coupled with enforcement. And enforcement is such a big part. Our partners at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration give us very good support through our Governor's Highway Safety Program to get some messaging out on this. And we do individually by law enforcement agencies do some outreach in our community, in schools, especially for new drivers. We want them to develop good habits and certainly see some of this. Things like mock crashes can really have substantial impact on our young drivers. We're working on a concept right now called a crash trailer, where it's going to be sort of a mock crash that's very professionally done on a trailer and that can be taken around the state. And I think that can be very impactful. And those are things that we need to continue to do.
Listeners, I'd love to know what you think about this and where you find yourself accessing this idea of a culture of impaired driving or distracted driving. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. And Ron is calling in from Crown Point, New York. Hi, Ron. What are you thinking about?
Yes, I was just wondering, you have people taking medical marijuana. If they get pulled over, basically they're going to get tested as well. Now, if that's the case, are they liable for, you know, being on the drugs while they're driving?
Ron, thanks for the call. Trish Conti, do you want to talk about that?
Absolutely. There's part of the statute that says even if you're taking medications with a prescription or otherwise, you still are not waived from the responsibilities of impaired driving. And I think an important thing to remember about medical marijuana is, yes, you might go to your medical professional and have a referral for whatever medical condition you have to use marijuana, but that doctor's not actually giving you a prescription. They are bound by federal regulations, and that would be illegal, and they would lose their license if they were to prescribe it. So what you're left with is someone going to a dispensary and self-medicating and self-regulating how much they take. The doctor's not going to say, take 3 hits a day, take 2 edibles every 4 hours. They can't do that. So you're left with people that decide how much they're going to take, how often, and what kind. And it's unfortunate that, you know, a lot of people think that they either drive better or they concentrate more under marijuana. And the studies have shown that that's just not true. There are cognitive and visual changes that happen in a person when they're taking marijuana, and that does impair their ability to drive.
And beyond marijuana, whatever prescription you're on, you know, leaving that aside, if you're taking a legal regulated prescription that people have been taking for 30 or 40 years, you're also not waived from the impaired driving statutes.
Absolutely. But again, just because something comes back on a test as being positive, that does not equate to impairment. It's up to the officer to relate what he saw to make that impairment leap. There is no prosecutor in the state, in the state's attorney's office, that will prosecute a case without having any evidence of impairment.
Let's go to Munir calling in from Burlington. Munir, go ahead.
Hi. I was calling to ask about the testing that you're doing on the side of the road. There's no quantitation to those tests?
For the oral fluid testing, no. It's not quantitative. It's just qualitative. So the test result will come back with either a positive or a negative.
Munir, go ahead. Any other questions?
No, the reason why I'm asking is because I spent 25 years drug testing people. We tested all the municipal workers and all the towns in Vermont, the highway department, the school bus drivers, fuel and oil companies. I mean, you know, it's a little different because it was DOT regulated on how it was approached. But, you know, we had sort of some of the similar things that what you're proposing we had to abide by as well.
Yeah, thanks for your question and comment today. I appreciate hearing from you. You know, we're talking a lot about impaired driving and driving tests. I want to bring up a couple of other ways that we're seeing people on the roads not being safe. One that's close to my heart at the moment is drowsy driving. You know, as the mother of an infant who does not sleep through the night ever, drowsy driving is a really big problem. If you are tired and you're on the roads, you are quite dangerous. And in fact, some statistics show that drowsy driving is as impairing as being drunk. Is that true, Lieutenant Flanagan?
Well, drowsy driving is an impairment. There's no question. You know, your physical abilities to react, your reaction time is impaired. Your eyesight potentially is impaired. If you're closing your eyes, you can't see what you're doing on the road. So that is significant. Vermont does not have a specific drowsy driving law. We do have a negligent operation law, which at times that could fall under the elements of that offense.
But does anywhere have a drowsy driving law? I mean, how could you police that?
I know the state of New Jersey has a fairly new drowsy driving law within the last couple of years.
So, and really that's if you fall asleep and go off the road, or if you close your eyes. I mean, you can't police people for being tired. Nobody would be on the roads.
So, yeah, I don't know how that's enforced, but you know, we certainly have vehicles that go off the road late at night at all times of the day. And sometimes people admit that they fell asleep or that they're tired. Other times they may not. So I think it's one of those areas like distracted driving that's very underreported.
Well, and certainly here at VPR, you know, we get police press releases from the state police and also from other places. And oftentimes you'll see in an accident that the driver has reported falling asleep or being drowsy or just closing their eyes for a second. And it does seem like this is a significant issue in many accidents, that you're seeing people who are drowsy, and that's actually leading to accidents. Is that something that you see on the roads?
We do. And, you know, we're seeing it on a regular basis. I don't think it's at epidemic proportions, but, you know, we put it into the same really category as a distracted driving. It doesn't meet the definition of an impairment, but it is an impairment.
Well, what about this idea of distracted driving? Of course, in Vermont now, the law says you cannot be texting. You cannot use a handheld device. And if you're under the age of 18, I think you're not supposed to have a cell phone on and with you at all, right? I mean, you have to keep it in your pocket or somewhere hidden away. If you're over 18, you could have, you know, a handheld device that you use earphones with or something like that. Trish Conti, are we actually seeing any reduction in fatalities or accidents from distracted drivers who are using technology because of our laws?
I actually can't speak to that because I don't have anything to do with those statistics. I don't know if Lieutenant Flanagan, if they track that in the state police at all.
We are tracking some of those. Again, that data sometimes is very difficult, especially when in our fatalities and our serious injury crashes. But and a lot of those things, as far as looking at someone's phone, may be subject to a search warrant. And people aren't always very forward about saying that I was using my phone. But one of the biggest complaints that I hear from the public commonly is people aren't putting their phones down. And if the phone is in your hand, you're in violation of the law, even if you're stopped on a public highway.
Right. That's a new part of the law. You cannot look at your phone at a red light.
Yes. And we need to look at some things, like we've had this law in effect now for over 3 years. And we had a soft approach to this where there was no points assessed for a first offense of violating the hands-free law. And I think that our legislature may be looking at adding points to that this year as a moving violation, so it's consistent with other moving violations in our motor vehicle code.
Well, I really appreciate both of you coming on the show today to talk about distracted and impaired driving, and it's really interesting to learn about some of the new developments coming through with drug testing for impaired drivers. Trish Conte is director of the Vermont Forensic Laboratory, and Lieutenant John Flanagan is Vermont State Police Commander of Traffic Operations. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up, we're going to go to the farming community. We'll hear how a young Rutland County couple have overcome the hurdles of operating their own farm and the help they received along the way. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. 8 years ago, Lindsay and Scott Corsell started a market garden of vegetables, herbs, and flowers in Shrewsbury. They managed hurdles and successes as young farmers, and along the way, they had the help and mentorship from West Rutland farmer Greg Cox. Now, their venture has grown into Alchemy Gardens. The Corsells told their story of farming to the Vermont Folklife Center for a series called Growing Food, Growing Farmers. It's focused on the Rutland County agricultural community. Each month, we'll be airing conversations from the series on Vermont Edition as part of a collaboration with the Vermont Folklife Center. Here are farmers Lindsay and Scott Corsell.
My name is Lindsay Corsell.
And I'm Scott Corsell.
And I live in Shrewsbury, Vermont with my husband, Scott, and our daughter, Ella, and our dog, Murphy. And we have Alchemy Gardens, which is a vegetable farm in Shrewsbury.
We're sitting just a quarter mile away. We have our two propagation greenhouses here. We also have like our packing shed, our walk-in cooler, and our wash area and all that sort of stuff right on site here. A couple of propagation houses where we start all of our plants early in the spring, and then we cure some of our crops like onions and garlic and squash, that sort of thing. And then we also have a garden where we got started in West Rutland. That's about half an hour away.
We met teaching ecology at an environmental education center in Maine, and we moved to Montpelier and decided to get a community garden plot. Scott totally fell in love with gardening, and I did too. And from there, we thought we'd see what it would be like to be farmers, and so we got an apprenticeship the following year at a farm called Foggy Meadow Farm in Benson. And we just learned an amazing amount about vegetable production, how to manage a business, going to market, those sorts of things. And the following year, we decided to just get started on our own, doing our own vegetable enterprise.
We started our own farm a little more quickly in that we had only apprenticed on a commercial farm for 1 year or for a 6-month season. So to go from that experience to being at the market the following year, I think is a pretty quick sort of turnaround. And that was mostly because it was made available to us by Greg Cox, and making farmland and equipment and wash area and all those like expensive things that can be a barrier to new and young farmers. All of those were made available to us. So it made it a very easy transition to go from working for someone else to starting our own farm.
Within the farming community right within Shrewsbury, there are a lot of people that have started enterprises in the last, 5 to 10 years. And we're all cooperating with each other, and everyone, I feel like, really respects each other and wants each other to succeed.
There's a lot happening in Rutland to be excited about. And now we're going to be having these refugee families settling here, which is very exciting. And the agricultural scene in Rutland has so much going on. And with Greg's vision, with the food center, there's like great potential. And so I think it's moving in the right direction. And that's part of the reason that we moved back here, was to like try to, you know, do what we could, because it often has such a bad reputation around the state. So yeah, just for people around the state to know that really good things are happening in Rutland, and not to just cringe every time you hear the word.
That's Lindsay and Scott Corsell, owners of Alchemy Gardens in Shrewsbury. This recording is part of a project developed by the Vermont Folklife Center with support from the Archie Green Fellowship. You can find a link to the entire Growing Food, Growing Farmers series at our website, vpr.net. You hear me mention our email and social media addresses a bunch of times in every broadcast, and many of you do follow up and get in touch with us. Our executive producer, Patty Daniels, joins me now to read some of the comments that have come into Vermont Edition recently. Hey, Patty.
Hi, Jane. So let's start with our show about Act 46, the education law that pushes school districts to consolidate. We went around the state and we looked at three districts with really different situations to learn how they're approaching consolidation.
And we got a lot of response to this show. Melissa says, we're really struggling in Ludlow. We recognize the need to improve our school system, but we are too spread out to utilize the building we already have. We really need to build a new school, but we have no funds.
And Margaret says, research from other states clearly and unequivocally demonstrates that, in time, consolidation does not provide a lifeline for small schools, but leads to school closures. The state doesn't close the schools. Their neighbors do. Within the next 10 years, Margaret continues, within the next 10 years, there will be increasing closures of small schools as a result of Act 46. Tinmouth has included specific language in their articles of agreement to prevent closure, but most other merger articles have not included protections to the extent that Tinmouth has, which also requires a community vote in addition to a unanimous school board vote prior to closure.
And Connie in Bennington emailed us to share her thoughts on the law. She says, Act 46 is an overreaching, devastating piece of legislation for Vermont families who care about education. Although the State Board of Education says it will not take away choice, further examination of Act 46 shows it is clearly designed to force communities to abandon choice and funnel down the same one-size-fits-all drain.
Well, that question of school choice is definitely one that we heard a lot about from a lot of you, and we are working on a program on that topic for a future episode of Vermont Edition. So last Friday, Senator Patrick Leahy spent an hour on the show answering your questions about the incoming Congress and the Trump administration. Stephanie posted to Facebook, I'm so grateful for the pragmatism of Leahy, Sanders, and Welch. A reassuring show. Thanks.
But Joe Henry disagrees and feels Leahy isn't doing enough, particularly when it comes to the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline. Joe Henry says Senator Leahy is more interested in being Vermont's cash cow than in the plight of the Native Americans as water protectors, which affects us all.
On Tuesday, our guest was journalist Theo Padnos. The Vermonter was held hostage by Al-Qaeda in Syria between 2012 and 2014. And in our interview, he described his experience and how he's recovered from it. On Facebook, several of you gave very quick reactions to this interview. Beth says, what an engaging interview, and thank you.
Margo says, wow, Theo, what an ordeal. Incredible. So glad you're home safe and sound.
And Ruth says, thank you, Vermont Edition, for bringing this to us and to Mr. Padnos for sharing. This is really informative and important.
And our story yesterday from Nina Keck about Pearl Harbor brought you the voices of Vermonters who remember the bombing 75 years ago and who served in World War II and sacrificed in different ways, including Nina's own family. Janet posted this note. I just heard this report at the end of the Noontime Vermont edition. This was an excellent piece, Nina Keck. Thank you and your mother for sharing your family's story. And thank you to both Lasita Cook and Don Shedd for sharing your stories and for your service.
And so please keep your comments coming and tell us what you think about what you're hearing on Vermont Edition. We're on social media at Vermont Edition. You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook. And our email address is vermontedition@vpr.net. We don't have time to reply to every email we get. There is not enough time in the day, but we do read them all. They come to our entire staff, and we really do think about what you're telling us, and we respond as best we can.
Absolutely. We appreciate all of the feedback, so thank you. And thanks, Patty.
You're welcome.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, former Attorney General Jeffrey Amestoy looks at the parallels between the 2016 presidential election and the political situation in Massachusetts in the mid-1850s. That's when a populist and nativism movement swept every elective office in that state. Amestoy will share the consequences of this development and what it had on future political movements. So join us live for that discussion tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Liam Elder Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.